that computer know who you
don't
are?
Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is me.
A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same
thing. I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my friend?
Onto a Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah. This is Tech Talk.
Machines can do the work.
Good morning. There we go. You know, the song's telling me machines can do the work, but apparently there's still something I have to do here.
That's a seductive message, isn't it?
and one that I fully embrace. I the more work that machines can do for me, the happier I am.
Yeah.
And we're going to be talking to a guy today, John McCormick, author of 9 Algorithms That Change the Future, the ingenious ideas that drive today's computers. He's going to tell us about how machines will do the work.
Good, good.
And they are doing the work.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the program. This is Michael Tech Talk Castle and Dave Sparky Saganaki. We're so happy to have you with us today.
Absolutely.
Welcome.
And Dave made it through the snow and everything. This is exciting stuff.
Oh, there's a ton of snow. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, you had to come further.
A little further. But we made it, and it's supposed to be a beautiful weekend, and you're enjoying it right now listening to the Tech Talk Show on WRLR.
So is Jay Garman going to be here later?
I hope so. Yes, I don't have confirmation, but I have hopes and prayers. yes, we have geek trivia to catch up on with Jay Garman. Jay, Encyclogarmonica, Jay Garman is going to be on here hopefully in just a few minutes.
It's a tongue twister.
Yeah, I know. I keep trying to think of a better or more mellifluous catchphrase that'll trip off the tongue.
Know-it-all.
Jay Know-it-all Garman. You know, there's kind of a negative connotation
there. Omniscient.
Omniscient works. Is he an autodidact? Did he come up with all of that knowledge himself? I think so.
Omni-geek.
We can call him an omni-geek, an autodidact. How about a factotum? How about that? That'll work,
I think we should probably brainstorm off the air.
That's a good idea. Man, you know, but I've had so much extra time on my hands this last week because, our hosting, we have a website, if you're not aware of it. It's techtalk.wrlr.fm. You can go there. You can also go to facebook.com/techtalkwrlr. And all those sites are going to direct you back to our web feed, our RSS feed, which hosts our podcasts and so on. That is on DreamHosters' website. And I don't know if you heard just this last week, but DreamHosters was hacked. They lost apparently a lot of user information up to and potentially including passwords, although the DreamHoster admins and owners have sent out emails saying that they do not believe that passwords were captured. They're taking every step they possibly can.
Let's take their word for it.
And this is the thing. We hear about this happening all the time, and now it's happened to me. It's not supposed to be like this. I'm supposed to be telling you the things that happened to you, not to me. So I got an email telling me that I need to change my password just in case.
And your belief system, you need to change your belief system about the dangers of the Internet.
Well, wait, is it nothing bad has happened yet? I just have a little bit of frustration in that I have to change. What happened, too, is this last week is what I discovered. And you, those regular and loyal listeners out there may have noticed that I did not post a podcast this week. And this is the reason why. I couldn't get in. What they did is they went in and proactively and preemptively changed everybody's password.
Well, yeah, they have to do what they have to do.
Which is a good idea, yeah.
Speaking of upload sites and download sites.
Ooh, I know where you're going with this.
Mega uploads.
Yeah, they
going to jail.
They got slammed. They got hammered. Hey, who needs SOPA when you can just shut them down?
First of all, I'm chagrined to say I didn't know anything about mega uploads.
Mm.
And they're saying it was 4% of internet traffic.
Yes.
That's the report. 4% of internet traffic I know nothing about. that either speaks to me being old and kaji, or that I'm honest.
I'd vote for the honest. Maybe.
maybe I'm just really ticked off at some of my friends for not telling me
about it. I didn't know about it. I did not partake of it. The danger with a lot of these file sharing sites, of course, is that you're running the risk that, you're dealing with criminals.
Well, we need to tell people what happened first.
Mega
Upload was a Department of Justice took it down. As I said earlier, it was 4% of internet traffic. 175 million users, I believe. Somewhere.
Wow.
So 180 million. That's what it was.
Wow.
And there's charges that. There was streaming. It wasn't publicly known. Their front page did not show that you could stream illegally or pirated material for free. But there were ways to get into the information, and the Department of Justice said stop doing that. And they were profiting from it. You could have a message, but a lot of people uploaded their personal information here. They looked at it as just file storage.
Yes.
And so the Department of Justice completely shut it down, and if you had anything stored on their site at all, it's gone.
Yes, yeah, and that is one of the issues and problems here, is that there were a lot of people that were using it for solely legitimate purposes.
Right.
And
on the face of it, it looked legitimate.
Well, if you went to their website, yes and no. One of the things that Mega Uploads made real easy to do was to search for these public and shared files, and that made it very easy for people to upload copyrighted materials and leave them there, and then for other users to find them easily and download them. And they had different ways of making money. They were selling ads, but I believe they also sold
subscription and
membership services. Much like RapidShare is another organization that does similar stuff. And with RapidShare and Mega Upload, as a free user, you can usually access the materials, but it'll take you a very long time, or you have to wait in a queue before you start your download. And so their money-making model was that, hey, you don't want to wait in a queue? Fantastic. Pay us, $10 a month or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then you can get to the head of the queue and download right away, and you get access to our higher bandwidth pipes and so on. And these were being service specifically, I guess, was not only – I mean, the charges, of course, are not only were they allowing for copyrighted materials to be hosted there, but were in some ways, condoning this activity in order to increase their revenues. And it makes sense. I mean, 4% of the internet traffic, you got to think that's a huge amount of money that you can potentially be raking in off of
that.
Well,
they said, in the indictment, it was 170. I remember it was a dollar per user. It was about $175 million.
Mm-hmm.
And they're charged with possessing or allowing to share like $500 million worth of material.
Yes.
Copyrighted material.
Yes. Now, and it's going to be an interesting court case because we did just have the recent SOPA issues and PIPA issues, and we talked to one of the late guys over at Reddit,
I missed Wikipedia for that day.
Yeah. Well, you could have gotten around it. You hit the escape button and
really?
You right through.
I didn't know that.
Sorry. Hey, if you listen to the Tech Talk show, that's the pro. Or followed us on Facebook, posted it.
You know
there
what?
Too.
It's too much knowledge for my puny brain to absorb. So I try not to listen.
I understand. Well, here's the interesting thing, though, about this is that Mega Uploads is in that gray area, though, still, where the individuals themselves were not putting, that own Mega Uploads were not putting these copyrighted materials up. They were just allowing for
they didn't steal the money. The money was in their house.
It was there. Look, I woke up and come on. What am I supposed to do? And so the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who is very strongly, supports the freedom of information and its transmission across the internet, has already stepped up and said that there's some problems here and that they're going to to assist in this fight and assist Mega Uploads in their defense, because they do think that this is going to be one of those watershed cases for copyright infringement on the internet. The statement from Kareem McSherry, who's one of the lead attorneys at the EFF, said, what we're talking about here is copyright infringement, and that may be a serious problem, but it's more than a little bit chilling if that can get you dragged from your house in the middle of the night. And which is exactly what happened to these guys, is they got pulled from their house in the middle of the night by guys with guns.
Yeah.
And there you go.
Ah. So. So what do you think about that? Do you think that was wrong?
In this case, I would say no. I think they're clearly in violation of our laws as they currently stand. I think that they were, certainly this was an intentional infringement. You know, this was not a case of a Google or a Yahoo or an, you know,
right,
somebody, you know, or me, for example.
It wasn't inadvertent.
You know, but yeah, having a link on there that went somewhere. It's like, oh, I didn't know, you know, or not even not just doing due diligence. It wasn't a fact that they just said, oh, we don't have the resources to scour our databases. They clearly knew this was occurring. They knew it was occurring not just in a small scale, but in a large scale. And that because this was providing them with their income and source of cash, they chose to ignore or promote it. And you know, look, what can you say about that? Whether you agree with the law or not, and maybe the laws do need to change. The fact of the matter is that they were intentionally and willfully sidestepping or crossing that boundary of the law.
Mm.
So.
And jail is a good solution for that, do you think?
Well, you know, that gets a little questionable too. You know, because you do need to have a point where, you know, I don't know. I'm not for jails, period. So ask me if jail is a good response in general. I don't know how much alteration in people's behavior occurs in a positive way because they've been incarcerated somewhere. I think that that as a response and an answer to you know, infractions is not necessarily a good solution, period. So what So I don't know how to answer your question. I know what you're saying to me. I think that there has to be a monetary redistribution here. They certainly gained a lot of money because of this activity, so it needs to be pushed back out to the people that they, you know, quote unquote, stole it from. I think there's issues with that. I think the whole thing's a mess. It's just all a big problem. I don't even know where to start. Turning the covers over.
Well. I don't know. I think it's hard to get a handle on. I mean, you want to protect rights, you want to protect freedom of speech and information, but, you know, like just an example, the movie Contagion, I don't think that's out on DVD yet.
No.
That was one of the movies cited, you know, that people could freely download.
Okay.
Contagion, I'm sorry.
I wanted to see that too, darn it.
Oh, no.
Wish I'd gotten on there a little quicker.
Oh, man. I was downtown with a very paranoid friend. I have a friend that's a little bit bug paranoid, and it was on what's the big screen? Cinemax.
What's
the name of it? Anyway.
Yeah, I know. IMAX.
That's it. Gigantic screen. Contagious disease. I was like, no. Well, let's go see that. No, we're not going to go see that.
Yeah.
But that's how much financial harm has that done to them, to the producers of that movie?
And this is part of the question is, you know, is it doing financial harm to them? In some cases, you can argue that it's actually promoting the movie.
I think
in the case of DVD, I think the problem is that there's a change in that landscape, is people are much less likely to purchase a DVD anyways, you know, with the advent of Netflix and so on. I think that working those licensing issues out is going to make piracy less of an issue. You don't see people standing on the street corners downtown Chicago waving DVDs in the air anymore. You know, that just doesn't is not occurring. Whereas, you know, 10 years ago even, it would. You would walk down and people would say, hey, I got your copy of Contagion. Hey, right over here. You know? And the reason it doesn't happen anymore, it's too easy. It's too easy to get it digitally now.
I think if you did that on a street corner with that voice, you get your butt kicked.
That was actually wasn't my Chicago accent. That was my Bronx accent.
Yeah, yeah.
I know it's tough to tell.
No, that was that was your Minnesota boy coming to visit the Bronx accent.
Yes.
Accent. Anyway, I don't know. I mean, first of all, a lot of these arguments that are being made against the internet now about, you know, harming businesses and were made against radio when radio first came out, when record companies did not want recorded music played on the radio because they thought it would harm their sales. And in fact, that kind of proved true. Record sales never kind of recovered from the introduction of radio. But then they kind of learned to coexist and actually used the radio to promote records. You know, I wonder if a similar model could happen for the internet. But you can't argue against theft, though, at this point.
I mean,
that's really what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and that's kind of where it's coming out. Hey, you know what? We got to get a call into Mr. Gunn. You know, I'm not used to being the one that's saying, "Hey, we're running late here." But
I'm giving up my clock. I'm giving up my watch.
Hello.
Good morning. There, wow.
Jay Garman.
One ring. Yeah, he's there.
one ring Garman.
Yeah, I like it. You must be snowed in with the rest of the Midwest here.
No, we've dodged that bullet so far, knock on particle board, but I think it's coming. I think it's out like some sort of predatory beast. Like, where have I not completely screwed up traffic yet? I got to go there.
Yep. I have to say, I have been, and you're traveling a lot now too, Jay, I see, with your trips back and forth to the East Coast. And I've been traveling a lot this month, and I have been so fortunate. I got out of Minneapolis hours before they started canceling all of the flights. I just the other night got out of Kentucky just again probably about half a day before the big dump came down, and so I have not had my travels messed up by it, but I know a lot of people have. How's your travels been? They've been pretty consistent and clean, and dodged some of those bullets?
Some, but not all. I made the really idiotic rookie mistake of flying through O'Hare Airport on my way back from Boston last Saturday.
Ooh.
And so, you know, I was only delayed by 2 hours, which I'm told in O'Hare hours is like really 15 minutes.
Yeah. That was pretty good. You you just slid right through that.
Totally.
It must have been on Untied. I mean, United that you were...
that would be correct. And here's what's really funny is that I don't actually think this was O'Hare's fault, other than the fact that O'Hare was involved. But I arrived at O'Hare on time from Boston, but the plane that was supposed to meet me and then take me to Kentucky was just hanging out in Dayton and refusing to leave. And that's literally what they told us, like, your aircraft is still on the ground in Dayton.
Yep.
Can you tell us why? Nope, it's just still there.
Why would you spend extra time in Dayton?
Yeah, exactly. What could possibly be keeping you in Dayton? Well, and you know, and that is typically what happens at O'Hare, is that O'Hare itself seems to run reasonably well. The problem is that they're this major hub for all of the other places to get their planes to, and all it takes is one little storm somewhere, and it'll mess your flight up regardless of where it is that you're trying to get to.
Yeah, exactly. There's some sort of queuing information theory, you know, that's being writ out into the world by virtue of these major aircraft hubs. Because Southwest doesn't have this sort of systemic failure because they don't have any hubs. They just sort of, it's all point to point, which I guess there's someone out there's going to write some sort of efficiency, you know, logistics paper based on this. Like, you know, at one point an undistributed node fails, it doesn't matter and so on and so forth. And
yeah.
I'm sure there's some network engineer right now just pounding his keyboard about how badly I mangled that description.
Well, and we may have him on in just a few minutes. We're going to have John McCormick, who wrote the book, 9 Algorithms That Changed the Future. And he's got some really good stuff in there. I bet he could probably even tell us a few things about that. I'm going to throw in a cool side of the week. On top of that, I've been really liking Hipmunk. If you get that for your mobile phone, if you get into O'Hare and you're like, what, they delayed my plane by 2 hours, I wonder if anybody else can get me where I'm going, Hipmunk is great. It shows all the flights that are coming up instantly from where you are and where you want to go to, and along with prices and agony rating. So It's
agony rating.
Agony rating. Yes, which is basically, do I have to stop somewhere else? What are the chances that it's going to be delayed as well? You know, that kind of thing. And it kind of coordinates that all together. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing. Hey, you know, speaking of John McCormick and that, I need to kind of move us along. I apologize. I called us called you in so late this week. But we should move into answering last week's geek trivia question and then finding out about this week's as well.
Well, the question was, what famous astronomer proposed a solution to the errors that are introduced in our year not being exactly 365.25 days long, and why it hasn't been implemented if it's such a good solution? And the astronomer in question is John Herschel, who is actually a little bit less famous than his father, William Herschel, because his father is the butt of a lot of astronomy jokes for having discovered Uranus. John actually introduced the Julian Day system, which is a 365.25-day increment from a date in, like, 4000 B.C., and astronomers still use this as a point of progression using this Julian Day system, and he also discovered a bunch of moons of Saturn and pretty much invented a whole bunch of photographic techniques that didn't exist, and he did this in the mid-1800s. He was inventing, you know, this sort of stuff. So he's really sort of this polymath genius. But his idea was that every 4,000 years, we put in a leap day that we wouldn't normally put in. For those who don't understand how leap day works, is it's every 4 years you put it in, except on a year that is a century year, like 1900. But you do put it in if it's a century year that's divisible by 400. So in 2000 we did it. But Herschel's solution was that in the year 4000 we would not do it, even though that's a century year that's divisible by 400, just to keep this progression off, because it's the day is like 11 minutes short of 365.25 days, but it's not exactly 11 minutes short. And the reason, besides the fact that no one wants to think about the year 4000, and this is the same reason, by the way, where they're debating whether or not to put a leap second in June.
And you'll check the news, they're still talking about clocks.
This. Is that the Earth doesn't have a consistent length of day at all. And I don't mean it's just slowing down. I mean, sometimes it speeds up, too. So trying to project out 4,000 years is completely ridiculous.
It's wobble. It's wobble, right? That's the problem.
See, I just...
Well, there's actually a lot of factors involved when you get into it. The main one is that the force of the tides slowly breaks the Earth. That's B-R-A-K-E, not B-R-E-A-K.
Yes.
It slows it down. But basically, our core is molten and doesn't have an even mass distribution. So anytime there's a significant shift in sort of the mantle or the core, the Earth can, by microseconds, speed up or slow down. In 1999, it sped up, and no one has any idea why. The Chilean earthquake in 2004 noticeably slowed the Earth. The earthquake was strong enough to actually slow the Earth's rotation down some.
And
earthquakes are known to do that. So trying to predict between now and the year 4000 exactly how many earthquakes or asteroid strikes or anything else that's going to have happened, I was like, you know what, John, that's a good idea in theory. We're just not going to mess with it. We can't even decide whether to put in a leap second this year, let alone whether or not to have an extra day in 2,000 years. So we're going to put that on the shelf.
That's why I just, you know, where I grew up, we'd go out, we'd look at the corn, and based on how high it was, you knew what day it was, and you looked at the shadow for the time, and if you couldn't see the shadow, you just went back to bed. So,
I didn't realize that you were from Punxsutawney.
Yeah.
I'm still using my wrist sundial myself.
Yeah. Man, yeah, and you know, and the thing with the about how the tectonic plates and all the stuff going on underneath the surface of the Earth affects it, I always think of that like you know, like an egg. And if you spin an egg, and you know, the stuff inside of the egg doesn't move at the same rate as the shell does, and that can it affects the rotation. It's like a gyroscope or anything else. So yeah, I can see that being a bit of a difficulty keeping track of stuff. I can barely remember that I'm supposed to come into the studio most days, so Oh, man.
Yeah, or get off the air. That's you can't.
Well, that's another issue, too. We'll be really I know we're going to be running into that today because So, Jay, well, thank you, Jay. And I don't think we got any correct answers.
Yeah, I bet customer Joe's didn't nail that one.
She did not. So that was a good one. What should we be thinking about for next week?
Well, this one is, I won't say sad, but it's a bit serious. On this Friday, January 27th, is the 55th anniversary of the Apollo 1 tragedy. And so every year when something like that comes around, I gotta make note of the sacrifice of those guys. And NASA's done that too. They've done plenty of stuff to note what they've done, but there were a lot of policy changes that came about because of the Apollo 1 capsule fire, not the least of which was that at launch, there is no longer a pure oxygen atmosphere in any spacecraft, and there's all kinds of other safety features. Hatches open out instead of in. They're much more strict about what can be flammable material, but there was a practical joke, an inside joke that the Apollo 1 crew used during their training that, as a tribute to them, became pretty much official NASA policy for the rest of the Apollo mission. Every other subsequent mission used this practical joke in a real way as part of their training and their actual mission conduct. So the question is, what Apollo 1 crew practical joke became official policy as a tribute to the loss of that crew?
Uh-huh.
That's a great question. Once again, you've got me stumped. I have absolutely no idea. Man, no, that's a good question. It's a good reminder too that this is an anniversary of another tragedy in our exploration of space, which hopefully will continue even with those.
The exploration, not the tragedy. Right?
Yes, yes. Thank you for helping me clarify that.
Nothing like tragedy jokes. Yeah.
You got a little golf there for a second. I hope the tragedy continues in our space flight because it makes it so much more epic. Like, wow.
Yeah.
That's a little dark there.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, and I want to remind people they can find more Jay at jaygarman.net, and there's always good stuff going on over there, things to look at. Jay, I hate to do it. I'm going to cut us off quick here, though. Thank you, as always, for coming on air, and look forward to talking to you soon. And hopefully one of these days I'll be back in Kentucky and actually somewhere where there's people, and I could visit.
That's the dream, man. That's the dream.
Yep. All right. Have a great weekend, Jay. We'll talk to you soon.
See you later, Jay.
Right, take it easy.
Good job.
Always great talking to
what
Jay.
What a great Garmin. Great answer, great question.
Yeah, that's Garmin, G-A-R-M-O-N, jgarmin.net. Check that out. I'm going to do this real quick, a couple of spots and promos and things like this. We're going to be back on in less than 2 minutes with John McCormick. He's probably sitting and going, why did these guys forget about me? Jay, John, if you're listening, we did not forget about you. We're going to be right back after this.
See you then.
You're listening to 98.3 FM, WRLR LP, Round Lake Heights, Illinois.
Snap Fitness Clubs of Round Lake are committed to providing a positive, clean, and safe environment for their health fitness members. Both Round Lake facilities offer 24-hour access 7 days per week. The phone number is 847-740-SNAP. The website is roundlakeill@snapfitness.com. Snap Fitness offers 2 Round Lake locations, one on Route 120 just east of Cedar Lake Road, and the second at Wilson Road by the Valley Lakes Water Tower.
A lot of kids need a place to live. A lot of kids don't have a good home. It's hard to imagine how difficult life is for these kids.
Each person has a different reason for becoming a foster parent through Camelot Care Centers.
It's been the most rewarding thing personally that I have ever experienced.
Camelot Care Centers, a foster agency for kids.
If we can just give them a good, safe home to live.
Camelot Care Centers, a foster agency for kids.
For further information on becoming a foster parent, Family Development Specialist Ginny Zarinaboff can be reached at 1-630-773-1985.
Maybe you can't change the whole world, but you can change the world of a child.
In the beginning, there was nothing except geek. Bleed geek, live geek, die geek, that's me. Latest news, comics, latest news, video games. You play it, you talk it, you read it, I talk it. This is Greg Sitkowski, radio host for Radio Geek Wednesdays, 5 to 6 p.m. on WRLR 98.3 FM. Radio Geek, it's live, it's fun, it's me.
All right. That sounds like a good show. I got
bump, bump,
I'm gonna have to
bump,
turn
bump,
into that.
Bump, 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 bump. Radio Geek, 5 to 6 on Wednesdays.
You got it. You got it. Okay, we're finally doing it.
Hello, John.
Good morning, John. John McCormick. I apologize. We're running even later than I promised you that I would run.
Not a problem.
John, get used to it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, I'd like to introduce John McCormick, author of 9 Algorithms That Change the Future, The Ingenious Ideas That Drive Today's Computers. John, can you do me the favor, the honor of giving us a little introduction of yourself and of the book, and then let's talk about it.
Sure. Well, I guess I'm a computer scientist. I've worked in a few different roles. I've worked in industrial research labs for Hewlett-Packard and Microsoft, trying to invent new computer technologies. And these days, I teach and research computer science at Dickinson College in Pennsylvania.
Fantastic, fantastic. And in your background, I know I saw on your bio, you've been kind of around the bend. You got mathematics in your background, which is a perfect grounding for computer science, which you did at Oxford. And it sounds like you've got an Australian accent. Is that correct?
I'm actually from New Zealand originally. I grew up in New Zealand, but I went to school in England. And I studied math for my undergraduate degree, which, as you say, is one of the one of many good ways of getting into computer science. And yeah, then at grad school, I ended up studying computer science. I actually studied in a subfield called computer vision, which is the area where you try and get a computer to use a camera to understand something about what it's seeing through the camera. And, yeah, as I said, I later ended up working for computer companies and now working in a college.
Excellent, excellent. And you came around and you wrote this book, and I'm gonna start off and let listeners know I've read a lot of the book, and I think I mentioned this to you earlier too. It's fantastic. If anybody out there who's listening who's interested in what really kind of is the hinge points of how our computer applications and our experience on the web works, put simply, it really is a well done book and very readable book. Whether you're in computers or not, and you shouldn't let the word algorithms scare you off. And John, I know you're going to tell us what an algorithm is and why algorithms are so important to the world and to computers.
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. But actually, since you mentioned the scariness of the word algorithm, I sort of had an interesting experience with that myself, because the first time I met with my editor for this book, we also met with the marketing director at Princeton University Press, and they told me under no circumstances may the word algorithm go in the title of the book, because it's just way too scary. And that was a couple of years ago. Since then, times have actually changed. If you search for the word algorithm on, say, the New York Times, you're going to find that it's coming up, dozens of times a month. So it's starting to enter the sort of lexicon of everyday use. Another place where you might have seen it, if you've seen the movie The Social Network, which is about the true life story of the founding of Facebook, it also comes up there in one very significant scene early on, where the guy who goes on to drop out of Harvard and found Facebook is desperately asking his friend, please tell me the algorithm that you use to rank chess players. So this word is actually starting to enter the popular consciousness. You've probably heard news reports about algorithmic trading on Wall Street,
yes,
which is when computers automatically conduct trades without any human intervention.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, let me answer your original question, which is, what on earth is an algorithm? And the simplest way of describing it is just to say it's a precise list or description of steps that you need to take in order to solve a problem. So at its most basic level, this definition actually has nothing to do with computers. We all learnt algorithms at elementary school and at high school. One of the simplest examples I can give you is the algorithm for adding up two large numbers. Suppose I gave you 2 four-digit numbers and asked you to add them up. You know, you're allowed to use a pencil and paper. You would have a set method of doing that, right? You would start at the right-hand side, add those first 2 digits that you see there. If the result is more than 10, you'd write down one of the digits and carry a 1 to the next column and so on. There's a bunch of steps that you learnt at school. And what you actually learned was an algorithm. It's a precise list of steps that must be taken in order to solve a problem.
And, of course, my algorithm today would be, number one, get a calculator, and then, or better yet, open Excel.
Right. Okay, yes. So the algorithm that you learned at school has actually been implemented as a computer program on, you know, every computer that you've ever used, including the most basic scientific calculators.
Yep, yep. Yep, and so an algorithm really is just, as you said, just a description. It's a recipe. It's something that we do anyways, but that can be easily replicated and consistently replicated. I think one way that I've heard it described is though to separate it is that we come up with things that we're very proud of in science and in physics and so on, and a lot of times what those things we come up with that we're proud of is it's a single formula or it's a what. It's a we discovered this thing. Algorithms are much more about the how, right? And
exactly. Yes. So, yes, often in physics, an important result is summarized in a formula. So Einstein's famous equation, E equals MC squared, is one of the great results of physics. In biology, say, in genetics, an important result might be summarized by a sequence of genetic code, C-A-G-T, something like that. Mm. In computer science, most of the important ideas are actually described by an algorithm. And exactly as you just said, an algorithm tells us how to do something, not, you know, the state of the world, such as E equals MC squared, which is a statement about the equality of two quantities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And of course, you know, without realizing it or knowing it or being aware of it, these algorithms are around us all the time. And and especially too, of course, as we work on computers. And I know some of your book talks a little bit about that that transition too. There's been some great historical texts written about how algorithms change from something that we do as humans into something that we could codify and place and have our machines do for us.
Yes. I mean, there's no doubt that everyone who sort of uses a computer today is just surrounded by algorithms. They're swirling around us. All of the big websites that we use, like Google and Facebook and so on, have ingenious algorithms running behind them, which give us the sort of fantastic services that we've come to expect as normal. But actually, I mentioned this very simple example of adding two numbers as an example of an algorithm, but really more profound algorithms have existed before computers came along. So probably the oldest recorded algorithm is known as Euclid's algorithm, after the Greek mathematician Euclid, who wrote down this algorithm over 2,000 years ago. And, you know, this is something that's used in mathematics. It actually it's used to, I'll use some technical words here, it's used to find the greatest common divisor of two different numbers. But I just mentioned that because that's thousands of years old, yet it's an algorithm. Coming up to more modern times, the person who many people regard as the founder of computer science was a British scientist called Alan Turing. And he is famous for, during the Second World War, doing secret cryptography work that helped to crack the German naval codes. And he was coming up with algorithms for decrypting these codes. Many people believe that these algorithms saved a lot of lives and helped to end the war earlier than it otherwise would have. And again, this was in the 1940s, just at the birth of the digital computer age, and these algorithms that Alan Turing was coming up with were actually being implemented partly by mechanical devices, partly by pencil and paper. So you can see that this concept of an algorithm is not sort of, it doesn't necessarily have to be linked to computers, but these days, of course, computers are the things that can execute algorithms millions of times faster than any other method we have, and that's where we really see the power of them today, and that's how it influences society.
Yeah, and you know, and that's a great example too. Is I definitely wanted to talk about Turing and about cryptography in general, because one of the algorithms that you talk about in your book, and you had to pick nine, I know, and one of them that you brought up was public key cryptography, or public key cryptography,
that's
which
right. Yep.
Allows us to share information that is confidential on the internet with at least some degree of confidence that this information is not going to be visible and available to people that we don't want it to be, such as our credit card numbers when we buy something on Amazon or eBay, any sort of confidential message and information. How did Turing doing this with mechanical components and pieces, and then you get to a stage where you don't have any. And this happened, of course, in World War II as well, where there was no presumption of secrecy in the message that was sent from one location to another. How is that being used today, those same kind of concepts today?
Right. Well, there's a lot of different parts to your question, so let me try and pick it apart a little there. We have to be a bit careful with our definitions. In fact, the crypto that Alan Turing was using in the Second World War was not public key cryptography. In fact, no one invented public key cryptography. It was completely unknown until the 1970s. Mm-hmm. So that's a particular type of crypto that is extremely important for how the Internet works today, but it was not being used in the Second World War. Now, so let's just sort of think a little bit about what the problem on the Internet that we have is kind of a new one that they didn't necessarily have, say, the military in the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
They had ways of distributing secret keys to all of their commanders, and these keys are what you use to first encrypt at one end and then decrypt at the other end a message. Now, when you, say, go to Amazon and decide you want to buy a book and type in your credit card number in order to do that, that credit card number is going to be sent to a server at Amazon somewhere that your computer has never communicated with before. There has been no opportunity to, in advance, agree on a key that you're going to be using to first encrypt the credit card number and then decrypt it at the other end. So this is a sort of extra problem that faces us on the Internet every time we want to have secure communication with another entity.
Mm-hmm.
And remarkably, this idea that was invented in the 1970s was actually invented by two completely separate groups of people that didn't know each other had done it. This invention allows you to agree on a key that will be secret. Even people who can listen to every single thing that you communicate with Amazon and everything that Amazon says to you, so if someone was somehow snooping on your communication, this is a remarkable and counterintuitive thing. But public key cryptography allows you to agree on a secret key that a snooper cannot obtain.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really, I mean, without this amazing piece of sort of algorithmic ingenuity that was invented in the 1970s, the Internet as we know it would simply not exist. It would be completely different. We couldn't have secure business transactions on the Internet.
Yeah, and the way that it's described in the book is great. And you use cans of paint and a variety of methods for making it actually surprisingly clear as to how this extremely complicated thing occurs. And it also, too, makes it easier to understand why some of these computer breaches now are occurring. One thing that you set up is an environment where you've got three individuals who are trying to communicate, private messages to each other, and you have that, supposed public area where everyone can see everything. But it also supposes that each individual has their own little private area that they can work from that the others cannot see. And
right.
And that, I think, it kind of gives us a clue as to why a lot of the direction and intrusion technologies that are advancing are not focused on capturing information that's being transmitted. They're really focused on getting behind that private screen so that they can decode these messages much easier by having that private piece, that single piece of private information that's required, whether that be your password or the keys and the hash on the other side.
Yes, that's exactly right. So, you know, what you pointed out there is an approach that I tried to take with all nine areas that are covered in the book, where, you know, these algorithms are explained without assuming any knowledge of computer science or mathematics. So, you know, the target audience really is people who hopefully are interested in finding out about computers and technology, but they certainly don't need to know anything about it. And the way that I've tried to do it wherever possible is by using analogies and examples of things that we do every day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that example of two people in a room trying to sort of exchange a secret message while someone else is also in the room listening to everything that they say and watching everything that they do, I mean, it's a little difficult to give all the details in a radio show or a radio podcast,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, that's the sort of way that I've tried to explain many of these algorithms. And then focusing on the particular thing that you identified there, yes, I mean, as we already discussed, public key crypto is this amazing idea that lets you agree on a secret key even when someone's snooping. And by the way, just in case people think that might be unrealistic, this analogy of sort of trying two people trying to talk in a room with someone else listening to everything they say, when your computer talks to another computer on the internet, and again, let's think of you on your laptop communicating with a server at Amazon, every single packet, every single piece of information that goes between those two computers typically goes through about a dozen other computers on its way. These computers are known as routers, and they are what direct all the traffic through the internet. And, you know, most of these are run pretty carefully by companies that know what they're doing, but you never know when one of those routers might have been compromised by a malicious hacker, mm-hmm. and that hacker could see every single piece of data that goes through these computers. So that's why it's a relevant analogy to think of, okay, two people standing in a room trying to communicate secretly while someone else can hear everything that they're saying.
Yes. Yeah, I even like, I think even better, the example that started off the chapter with, you know, sending a postcard instead of something in an envelope. You've written
right.
your information on the postcard. Clearly, everyone that touches that can see and read that information and use it however they see fit. So being able to develop this methodology for communication really was a vital part of creating the Internet as we know it today.
Yes, exactly right. I mean, communication on the internet is like sending postcards. Everyone that sort of touches that postcard on its way through the system can glance at it and see everything on it. So if it's not encrypted, people are going to know what's there.
Yep. Now, another one that you brought up here, too, which I think is just as vital and that we certainly I experience every single day, is starts off the book with search engine indexing. And, you know, this is so much in our consciousness right now, but I think so very misunderstood, or you know, it's kind of like, you know, with your car, you turn your car on and it runs. I go to Google and I type words in and magically things come up. How does search engine indexing, I mean, just even some basic handle of how that happens?
Right. Well, I mean, this is such a sort of feature of our lives now, and we've really just come to expect this extraordinary level of service from search engines like Google and Microsoft. Bing search engine is another one. And it's such an important aspect that I actually devoted two chapters of the book to web search. The first one talks about indexing, and the next one is another algorithm that many people believe helped to launch Google into its premier position in the web search world. An algorithm called PageRank that was invented by the two founders of Google, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. But let's go back to the first one that you asked me about, which is search engine indexing. So, I mean, here's the problem. There are literally billions of web pages out there on the World Wide Web, and when you enter a query, you want to know more or less instantaneously which of those pages actually match your query.
Yep.
Well, how do we do it? It's the very first simplest solution is the same way as you would look up a term in the index of a book. So how does the index of a book work? Well, all of the terms that you might be interested in looking up are recorded in the index, and we note which pages they occur on and list them in alphabetical order so that we can easily find them. So this is the very first basic step in constructing a web search index, but Google does have an index of everything on the web, and it's stored in something that is a bit like alphabetical order, and after every term that you might search for, they have a list of all of the pages where that term occurs.
Mm-hmm.
So this is indeed, an index. It's called indexing, and computer scientists study indexing as a topic in its own right.
Yep. Yep, and one of the things that you do too is you talk about and you do this with all the algorithms. I love this. Is you break them out into tricks too, and and ways that make this easier. You know, obviously, just creating lists of words that happen to be in a document isn't going to give us tremendous depth of information about what it is that we've discovered. But using tricks like the meta word trick, and then later when page rankings, looking at the random surfer trick and things like
right.
this. Yeah. Really make a difference.
Yeah, so this was one of the really cool things, and it was really gratifying to me as I was working on the book, was I sort of was amazed to discover that all of these algorithms I chose to explain actually do boil down to relatively simple nuggets of ideas that make them work. And I've given each one what I hope is a cute label, the such and such trick, just to try and help us sort of remember and understand what is the key idea in each algorithm. So let's just take one of the ones you mentioned there, the meta word trick. So this is to do with web search indexing, and I sort of simplified the problem when I described it before. I said all we want to do is, from all the billions of web pages out there, find the ones that match the query that you put in. Well, that's not good enough. You might put in a query that has tens of thousands or even millions of matches. And obviously, you don't want to comb through tens of thousands of results to find the thing that you're actually interested in. So web search engines have to not only find all the matching pages, but rank them in such a way that they can present to you just the top few that you're willing to spend some time looking at. And they should present to you the most relevant ones to your query. This is a very hard problem for them to solve, and there are many, many ways of sort of improving the ranking of web pages. But one of them is via this thing called the meta word trick. And the idea is, well, we'd like to know if on a particular page, suppose you entered the query Tech Talk. You're looking for your own podcast. You want to quickly find it.
I do this all the time.
Right. So a page that happens to have the word tech and talk somewhere in it may be relevant to your query, but a page whose title says Tech Talk has a much higher chance of being relevant, and we should rank it higher.
Mm.
So the problem is that in that index that I described before, the list of places where the word tech occurs would just be a big list of web pages on the internet, and the same with talk. So the question is, how do we know whether it was in the title or not? Well, it turns out that through this thing called the meta word trick, which is actually pretty simple, but I'm not going to go into the details of it right now, there's a pretty small change we can make to this index that will enable us to know whether a word occurred in the title, or was it labeling an image or something like that. And this can help search engines to greatly improve the ranking of that list of results that they give you.
Yep. Yep. And as you identified too, of course, and as we mentioned earlier, knowing how this works also allows you to understand a little bit how some of this web spam and search engine optimization, quote unquote, can operate, and how the attempts are made to fool these algorithms. Because these algorithms, as we said earlier, these are not things that humans have to be involved with. These are just rote recipe material that go through, and using them against themselves, I guess, is
yes, absolutely. It sounds like you're well aware of the fact that there's a constant arms race between web search companies on the one hand and so-called search engine optimization companies on the other. So these search engine optimizers are people that claim to improve the ranking of your own website. If you become a customer of them, they're going to improve the ranking of your website on search engines. And to do this, they reverse engineer how they believe search engines like Bing and Google work, and try to craft certain aspects of your page in a way that it's going to be ranked higher. Now, of course, Google and Microsoft do not want pages to have an artificially inflated rank, and so they have teams of scientists constantly working on this problem, which is actually known as the web spam problem.
Yep.
An analogy to email spam. This is sort of unwanted web pages that rise up the rankings because someone has done something artificial. And those teams of scientists are constantly working on new ways of combating web spam. It's discussed at conferences all the time. Academic computer scientists publish on this topic, and it's a mini industry in its own right.
Absolutely, absolutely. Hey, John, I apologize. I'm going to have to pull us to a quick closer. I believe that people have at least gotten a taste for some of the information that's available, but, man, there are so many places we could go from here with databases and data compression, pattern recognition, digital signatures, error. I mean, it just goes on and on. It's a fantastic book. Where can people find more information about 9 algorithms that change the future and the book and yourself?
Well, thanks to search engines, it's actually pretty easy. If you type 9 algorithms into your favorite search engine, you're going to find some links pretty quickly. There's a Facebook page, facebook.com/9algorithms, for instance. I maintain my own page about it, but any search engine will get you there very quickly, so that's probably the easiest way.
Fantastic. So thanks to one of those algorithms, you'll have no problem finding the other 8.
Right, exactly.
Well, John, it has been an honor. Thank you so much. What a great conversation, we wish you all the luck.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a pleasure being on the show.
Take care. Have a great weekend.
Bye now. Bye.
Good job.
John McCormick with 9 algorithms that change
Exciting
the future.
Stuff,
yeah, it really, really is. And I can't talk highly enough about it. I don't want to sound like a shill, but it is a great book. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. It was one of those perks of being a radio
available
guy.
Through Princeton Press.
Available through Princeton Press, Amazon. There's a number of places to get it. It is really very, very good. We are out of time. I am not going to do any Cool Sites of the Week. I'll put up links to the book, links to John's page. I'll give you a link to that Hipmunk as well that I mentioned earlier. And I'm going to leave you with a podcast-only song of the week. It's by Frightened Rabbit is the name of the band, and off of their album, The Winter of Mixed Drinks. And which is good just for that. The title is Swim Until You Can't See Land. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this week, I hope you'll stick around and come back next week, and don't forget to check us out on facebook.com/techtalkwrlr.
Thanks for listening to WRLR Round Lake Heights.
Have a great weekend.
And a knock to the board, and that drove me here to face the tide and swim. I swam, oh, swam. Dip a toe in the ocean, oh, how it hardens and it numbs. The rest of me is a version of man built to collapse and crumb. And if I hadn't come now to the coast to disappear, I may have died in a landslide of rocks and hopes and fear. So I swim until you can't see land.